renewed with equal measures of awe and aversion, feeling the colour and tone of the room change as he stepped through the door, the greys and browns transforming into golds and bronzes. I could be late, too, with difficulties getting away from Chilbury Manor, bad weather, interfering sisters, demanding fathers, and so forth. We were both willing to wait. Wait as long as necessary. Well, in that case... She wavered, unable to finish. After a moment's pause, I simply blurted out what had been going through my mind. I think my father might have shot him. She stopped mopping my head for a moment, a look of anxiety covering her face. Does your father know about the pregnancy?
Yes.
I looked up at her. Someone must have told him last night, before he got home.
Could it have been Miss Poultry?
Did you tell her?
I gasped.
She wouldn't have told him, knowing he'd kill me. My mouth went dry.
Would she?
Mrs. Tilling grimaced. I'm not sure, my dear. She shook her head with wonder. I'm really not sure. She tucked me in and went to get me some hot milk to send me to sleep again. She's worried that I'll lose the baby. And it scares me, too, more than I can say. If Alistair is truly gone, either by the bomb or by the gunshots in the wood, then this baby's the only part of him I have left. And I know it sounds sentimental and ridiculous, but I miss him as if I were dying in some way. My insides melting into me, slowly dissolving into nothing. This baby, his baby, is my only hope, the one bright star in a body of hopelessness.
Oh, Angie, it's so dreadful that you're not here with me.
Poor Hattie. I still can't believe that our lovely, warm, bright-eyed friend has gone. I don't know what I'll do without her. I can hear her voice in my head saying, Venetia, you need to learn to look after yourself. As I listen to Rose's gurgling, I feel a closeness to her, and have decided that I owe it to Hattie, who was like an older sister to me, to be an older sister to Rose. Do write as soon as you can. Much love, Venetia.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Saturday, the 3rd of August, 1940. What a horrific couple of days. I have a truly bad feeling about this war, that we will be overtaken, lose our country, our culture, our freedom, that we will give everything, all our fight, all our hopes and dreams, our very selves. Then the Nazis will come and there will be nothing left. We will be hollow skeletons, letting them walk all over us, leaving them to run our lives, our homes, our children, if there are any left. According to Colonel Mallard, the bomber probably overshot Dover, got lost, and then had to drop its bombs in order to make it back over the channel. It shouldn't have struck civilians. All that loss. And it was only a horrendous mistake, an afterthought. Venetia went home this morning and still isn't doing well. She's lost a lot of blood and I worry that she'll lose her baby. The concussion was a bad one and she's not herself at all. She's incredibly sad about Hattie, and is still talking about Slater as if he'll come back. No body was found in what remained of his house, and she can't seem to work out where he could be. The square is now bereft of one side. We've been working hard, the women of the village, to clear it away, trying to make the best of the uneven pile of bricks and broken things, some of which are deeply unsettling, like Hattie's familiar dresses, Prim's broken gold ornaments. Meanwhile, a growing number of scavengers have been scouring the remains for jewellery or trinkets. Yesterday I saw Ralph Gibbs pushing a woman aside to get to some treasure first, his eyes crazed with greed. This war has turned him into a monster. Miss Poultry's house was also wrecked, but luckily she was pulled out of the debris with just a fractured hip. They took her to Litchfield Hospital, so perhaps when I have time to visit, I'll question her about this curious baby affair. Yesterday, Mrs. Quayle found the remains of Prim's gramophone player and a few other items. The vicar told us that we can give them to Prim's sisters tomorrow, as they're to come for a special eulogy in the Sunday service. We also found some of Hattie's things, including a metal biscuit tin with Hattie's letters. Everyone said I should take it with me to give to Victor's aunt when she comes to collect the baby. So I brought it home and asked the Colonel to force it open as it had been melted closed. "Isn't that illegal?" he asked, all puffed up about doing the right thing. "Open it," I said. "I will take the responsibility if you have a problem with it, and I'll find a way to open it myself if you don't oblige." He looked at me as if I'd gone quite mad. "Someone has to open it eventually," I said quietly. "And I'm quite sure Hattie would rather it was me and not Victor's aunt, wouldn't you think so?" He harumphed, and then set about prying it open with a screwdriver. Once open, he handed it over to me, and I leafed through the contents. "Don't you feel like you're rifling through someone's private life?" "No, I feel like I have no time for questions at the moment." I carried on for a moment and then stopped and looked up at him. "I just want to make sure that the family loves the baby, loves the memory of Hattie, that they give her a welcome home." I looked back down at the tin. "We can't have them finding this love letter that's not from their nephew," I said, taking a letter and making a pile for things I'd keep to one side. "Or this one." "Yes, yes," he said. "I suppose you're right. How knowing of you." I stopped leafing through and looked up at him. "It's only what I'd like someone else to do for me." I thought I'd start crying, knowing Hattie like I did, knowing how she loved that baby, loved her husband. How ironic that she'd been so worried that something would happen to Victor somewhere in the Atlantic, when it ended up being her who was killed. "You're a brave soul," the Colonel said gently. And he put his big hand on my upper arm and held it there for a moment, oddly comforting in the stark new light of day. There was a photograph of Hattie and the whole group, Venetia, Henry, Angela Quayle, then my David, and Ralph Gibbs from the shop. They were walking down the lane towards Chilbury Manor. Someone had taken the photograph while no one was watching. Victor, maybe? They'd separated off from each other, Hattie and Venetia in the foreground, smiling and linking arms, David and Ralph laughing and pushing one another, looking so young and innocent, before the war came and dragged them quickly into adulthood. And then at the back, half hidden, were Angela and Henry, holding hands. She was whispering something into his ear, her other hand touching his arm, and he was laughing. They looked like lovers. I wondered why I hadn't worked that out before. Angela was in love with Henry, but he was always infatuated with Venetia. If you look closely at the photograph, you can see that his eyes are on Venetia as she slinks ahead, while Angela's eyes are directed sideways to him. I wondered if Venetia knew. Probably not. "What are you going to do with them?" the Colonel asked, glancing at my pile. "I'll put them in an envelope and give them to Rose, when she's old enough to understand," I said, straightening the small pile gently, as if it was to be a precious treat for the future. "She won't know anything about her mother growing up with just her father. These few items will help to fill in some of the gaps." "You can't draw a picture of someone who's dead," the Colonel said plainly. "Believe me, I've tried. There's so much that is intangible about a person. All those little details, their past. Those annoying little habits, the way they speak, their natural perfume. It's those things, and countless more, that gives them that fullness of life that you just can't recreate. You can use photographs, portraits, poems, scents. Everything you can find to remind you of them, but to convey that essence of a mother to her children is at best sketchy."
"Did you lose your wife?"
I'm so sorry. I must have blushed furiously as I thought of the horrid ways I'd treated the poor man, when really he was widowed too, just like me, and I'd never thought to ask him. Yes. He glanced out into the garden where a breeze was catching the clematis, swaying the maturing violet blooms up and back. My daughters were 7, 9, and 10 when Vera died. They remember her as a sick woman, demanding, queasy, often quite scary. It's a tough task persuading them that once she was a vibrant, beautiful person. He picked up the photograph of Hattie and looked sadly down at her. She too had vitality and dreams, just like this poor woman. I was quite struck by his words. I hadn't known that he had a wife who had died, although he had mentioned his children in passing. I suddenly felt dreadfully sorry for him. After all, I knew how it felt to be all alone, bringing up the children, forging on. David was only 8 years old when Harold died. We carried on by ourselves, all right, became very close. Where are your children now? Oh, they're in Oxford with their aunt, my sister. And they're older now. 12, 14, and 15. I was thinking of renting a place down here and bringing them to live with me. I miss them, you see. He coughed slightly to offset his bluntness. But now, yes, they're probably better off up there for now, I said quietly. And I found myself struck by the fact that he'd been thinking of leaving and renting a house, instead of living here at Ivy House. Didn't he like it here? Why hadn't he told me? Maybe I should have made him feel more welcome. So I made us both a fresh pot of tea, and as he sat with me at the kitchen table, I asked him all about his girls.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Monday, 5th of August, 1940. Life without Prim. This evening we had a special choir practice. The first without Prim. I could hardly bear to walk into the cold church knowing she'll never be there again. Our choir will never be the same. Many of us won't be able to go to Prim's funeral as it's to be held in London, so the vicar held a special Sunday service for her yesterday. He asked me to say a few words, which was such an honour, and I decided that I would tell everyone about my time with Prim. How she was such a tremendous force in our lives. When it came for my time to speak, I wasn't sure I could do it, trembling with nerves and sadness as I stepped up to the pulpit. But then I remembered Prim. How she would want me to be strong. At my very first lesson in Prim's house, we spoke about dying. She told me how she'd nearly died of malaria. She said that she didn't mind the thought of death. That realizing you're going to die actually makes life better, as it's only then that you decide to live the life you really want to live, not the one everyone else wants you to live, and to thoroughly enjoy every minute. I paused to pull myself together. The whole village was there, and some people from Lichfield too, all waiting for me to speak. It's shattering that she's gone, that she wouldn't have wanted this service to be about her death, but to be a celebration of her life. She was the most vibrant person, the most energetic, the most real person, and she'll always be alive to me. I began to cry, and Mrs. Tilling came to help me back to my seat. It's just so hard to come to terms with the fact that her immense presence is gone. Tears were pouring from our eyes as we sang, "Come down, O love divine!" Her fierce bravado will be sorely missed, and as I looked around the choir stalls, I wondered if it could have seeped into each one of our choir members. But just by being around her, we've become more fierce and brave ourselves, ready to take on the world in her place. What happens when people die? Their souls may go to heaven, where I might see them again when I die, although I'm unsure how they'll look by that time. Their bodies go into the ground where they become a feast for earthworms. Their presence lives on in everyone who knew them, as if we took that responsibility when we met them, without even being asked. Their essence is refracted into the universe, where it colours the air with their hues, eventually bleeding into the sunset with the other colours, a march of the dead every evensong. The question of who will lead the Chilbury Ladies' Choir. At choir practice this evening, we had to work out what we're going to do for Hattie's funeral, which is tomorrow. Predictably, Mrs. B quickly took charge in Prim's place, but her busy hornet ways seemed so brisk and artless compared to the close memories of Prim. "After our tragic week, we're here today to rehearse for Hattie's funeral," Mrs. B began. "As one of our leading second sopranos, we owe it to her to give it our very best." "It would be the very least we could do for her," Mrs. Tilling chimed in, coming forward. "I can hardly bear for us to sing without her, but I know it is what she would have wanted. She would want us to give her the best funeral singing we've ever performed." There was a mumble of agreement, and then Mrs. B called for silence.
"Yes, yes, everyone knows that, Mrs. Tilling. Thank you for your thoughts. We'll take that into consideration."
She ushered Mrs. Tilling to sit back down, but Mrs. Tilling was busy looking through some sheet music at the front, and Mrs. B, visibly bristling, continued,
"After much thought, I think it would be best for us to sing Ave Maria again for the funeral. We can try our best, with my leadership, to repeat our glorious performance in Lichfield."
More kerfuffle. No one wanted to sing Ave Maria again. Somehow it seemed wrong to simply churn out something we sang to win the competition when this certainly didn't feel in any way victorious. We looked to Mrs. Tilling, who was busy looking through a pile of music scores. "We can't sing that," she declared, popping her head up from the music. "It's completely wrong for the situation. No, we need something else. Something for Hattie."
"Maybe we could try Mozart's Lacrimosa now that the special memorial service Prim was planning is cancelled. I know that we need to work on it, but it is meant for a funeral," Mrs. Quayle called.
"No, that's not right either," Mrs. Tilling sighed. "It's too heavy and dramatic. Hattie would have wanted something simple, like a favourite hymn."
"Indeed, Mrs. Tilling," Mrs. B snapped. "Tell us, pray, what do you have in mind?"
"Well, the vicar left us all the old music from the church. It's a bit dusty, but I'm sure we can find something in here." I went up and helped her look through. Some of the copies were very tatty, and sometimes there simply weren't enough to go around, even if we shared one copy between three or four of us. We'd never be able to get more music in time. "What about this?" I called, holding something up. "Handel's Messiah?" "A touch too celebratory, perhaps, Kitty," Mrs. Tilling said kindly, flipping on through. "Ah, here we have it. Amazing Grace. One of the most moving pieces of music ever written." Everyone murmured, and it was generally acknowledged to be an excellent choice. "Its beautiful anthem brings the whole of life together," Mrs. Tilling said wistfully, then added decisively, "It is just the thing." She handed out the sheets and everyone began humming the music. We went to our places and looked up, ready to begin. "Are you going to lead us, Mrs. Tilling?" I asked. She was the obvious person, as she can read music and has a very good voice too.
"Yes, are you going to conduct?"
a voice from the altos called. "Well," Mrs. Tilling stammered. I could see she was uncomfortable, slipping into the shoes of Prim. Such a unique presence and authority, when she'd only been dead a few days.
"Go on, Mrs. Tilling," Mrs. Quayle called from the organ. "You're the only one who can."
Mrs. B, who had remained at the front, moved to the centre and said,
"Now I don't think we should force poor Mrs. Tilling. After all, she only stepped forward to help us find the right piece of music, and now that's been done, she's very much needed in the altos."
She smiled benevolently at Mrs. Tilling, her hand outstretched to guide her back into her place in the choir stalls. For a moment, Mrs. Tilling looked as if she was about to head back to the altos. But then something held her back, and she stood up straight and smiled at Mrs. B. "I can do it, I think," she said. "It won't be the same as Prim, but we all have to do our best." I'll be able to lead us in and keep us in time, and make sure the crescendos and rallentandos are done just right. I'll do it.
That's the spirit, Mrs. Tilling,
Mrs. Quail called, among the other voices and nods.
You are the best we have. You'll do a fine job.
I watched Mrs. B walk back to her place, head held high to conceal her annoyance.
I've never seen her vanquished like that before, especially by her usually loyal supporter, Mrs. Tilling.
The tables are turning.
Mrs. Tilling did not have a baton, but she raised her arms and nodded to Mrs. Quail at the organ to begin. Then she looked straight at me, as if she knew that I would lead the sopranos in, and a few tears began to form as I remembered lovely Hattie, a girl who'd always been part of my world, which was slowly but surely breaking up, dissolving in a way that can never be reversed. Venetia is the hero of Chilbury. The village square is in chaos. The shop is closed. But worst of all, Venetia is the hero of the hour. I can't go anywhere without being bombarded with questions about Venetia. How did she save the baby? Did she get the cake Mrs. Quail baked for her? Was she going to receive a medal of bravery? It's all poor Venetia and well done, Venetia. She was lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Anyone would have done as she did. I most certainly would have, had I been there. Then I would have been the hero. But Venetia is pregnant. Our maid Elsie told me this morning, making fresh scones to tempt me into the kitchen.
"Did you hear the latest news?"
she said softly, lavishing butter onto another for me, proffering a dish of strawberry jam in my direction.
"What news?"
I said through a full mouth.
"About Venetia having a baby." She turned away so that I couldn't see her face, her apron swooshing out around her narrow frame like a ballerina. She has that tall, picturesque look that looks wonderful from a distance. Only close up you get to see the sullen bitterness in her eyes. It quite ruins the effect. Today she was looking happier, however, a twinkle in her great green eyes like a sorcerer's cat on the prowl. "I heard about her rescuing the baby," I began, but she butted in rudely.
"No, her own baby." She turned towards me and pushed her pointy face into mine. "Mr. Slater's baby." I took a step back. "Venetia's pregnant."
"Shh," she quickly said. "Don't tell anyone I told you."
She must be scared someone will say she's been gossiping or causing trouble. She turned and dashed out of the kitchen, leaving me confounded, then dismayed.
Suddenly everything makes sense. Why Daddy is furious with Venetia. Why Venetia is not speaking to Daddy. Why Mama is excessively concerned about Venetia's health. Why Venetia is extremely upset that Slater is missing. Why everyone is acting very oddly and, worst of all, why no one is telling me a thing about it. Yet it seems strange that Elsie should be the one to mention it. She hardly speaks to me at all. I've often wondered if she has a chip on her shoulder about being a servant. Venetia says that's why getting staff is so difficult these days. No one wants to be bossed about. Maybe Elsie was getting her own back on us, especially now that she has twice as much work since Proggett left. We hadn't seen him for a day or so, and forced open his room. It was completely cleared out. He must have left the night of the bomb. We're all baffled. Except for Daddy, who's completely livid. I decided to find Mama to ask why she hadn't told me about Venetia being pregnant, but when I found her in the nursery with whining Lawrence, I chose not to say anything. Sometimes it's best to carry on as usual so that no one suspects that I know. I've been thinking about it all day, though, turning it over and over in my mind. I can't help relishing the idea that this will surely be the end of Venetia. This will put her on a back foot for the rest of her life.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Tuesday, the 6th of August, 1940. In the bleak afternoon drizzle, our small sobbing group huddled outside the old church, chilled and nervous, for Hattie's funeral. the final switch on dear Hattie's life. The proper end that was supposed to round the whole thing off, but seemed so contrary and out of place for such a vibrant, warm-hearted character.
It's just so hard to believe that she isn't going to come careening around the corner, her usual beaming smile across her face,
Kitty whispered with a loud sniff, and we looked over to the corner where she might appear. I feel that she's with us in spirit, I replied, clutching baby Rose closer, her little face smiling on this dreadful day that would change her world forever, almost definitely for the worse.
She doesn't know her mother's gone, does she?
Kitty murmured. No. And it'll be a few years till she's old enough to understand. She'll never have known Hattie, only Victor and the people who look after her.
Who is going to look after her until Victor gets back?
Kitty's eyes darted from the baby to me. It was a good question. Victor's aunt wrote to say they're too frail to have Rose. I hadn't realized they're in their 80s now. Sadly, they couldn't even make it for the funeral. So Rose has been staying with us, the Colonel and me, at Ivy House for now. I suppose I'll have to find a home for her, a nice family to foster her. No one's heard a thing from Victor for months, although the Colonel had his ship checked, and it seems it is doing all right somewhere in a remote part of the Atlantic. Victor probably hasn't even heard about Hattie's death. He might be still in a different reality, where his wife and new daughter live happily in their small, snug home, while he is the one facing the bombs. He is the one risking his life so that they may live free. Oh, the wretched irony of it all. Before the vicar opened the big church doors for us to enter, he crept out to have a word with me.
"We haven't any pallbearers," he whispered hurriedly.
I looked at him, puzzled.
"There are no men to carry the coffin," he elucidated, coughing to cover his embarrassment.
We looked around. A group of mothers and children from Hattie's school had come, but apart from old Mr. Dawkins and the Brigadier, who was clearly in no mood for carrying coffins, we were all women. The world seemed to fade in front of me. Dear Hattie, who was like a daughter to me, taken from life so early, and we couldn't even give her a proper funeral.
"Sorry," the vicar muttered. "Our usual bearers are at war, in the field, or making bombs. There's nothing I can do."
"Everyone's harried these days," I said quietly, annoyed that this wretched war is making us too busy for everything. "If something needs to be done, it's up to us women to make do." And then it dawned on me. "We will carry the coffin," I announced. A sea of faces looked up. There was a moment of shock when everyone seemed to look from me to the vicar, registering the situation. Then, after a few whispers, a few murmurs, one by one, they all began to step forward. First Kitty, then Mrs. Winthrop and Venetia, Mrs. Gibbs, Mrs. Turner and Mrs. Poultice, then Mrs. B. And soon everyone had silently volunteered. "The Tilbury Ladies' Choir will bear the weight," Mrs. B. declared, taking charge in her usual manner, which for once was useful. "We will carry Hattie, our loyal second soprano, on her final procession." As the vicar led the way into the vestry, I realized I needed someone to hold baby Rose. And after looking around, I knew that I had no choice than to pass her over to the Brigadier. "Could you hold Rose for a while, please?" I said sharply, bundling her into his arms. And he was surprised into taking the infant, looking down into the blue shawl with a frown over his face. I paused for a moment, wondering whether he registered that this beautiful girl was, if my suspicions were correct, his own child. Might he have felt a shudder of remorse?
"Lead on, Vicar," Mrs. B. called, and we followed him into the vestry, where we caught our breath at the sorry sight of the coffin, a slim wooden box containing all that was left of our precious Hattie. what was once a vivacious, energetic young woman, was now a pile of sad, dead remains, without colour or life, set inside a still box. "How are we to lift it?" Mrs. Gibbs asked nervously. "Everyone who feels strong can take a corner, and the rest of us will fill in around the edges," Mrs. B ordered. The mood became sombre as we hoisted our fellow choir member up, at first a little wobbly, but then we straightened up and began to walk out into the entrance hall, waiting for Mrs. Quayle to begin the organ processional. But Mrs. Quayle had different ideas. At the precise moment we stepped out down the aisle, the ponderous introduction of "Abide with Me" began to sound, forthright through the old church. The simple and yet poignant tune pouring softly from the organ, urging us to sing as a united front, for Hattie, for Prim, for our small yet resilient community, for our dear collapsing country. "Abide with me, fast falls the even tide. The darkness deepens, Lord, with me abide." Thus it was that a shuddering chorus of 12 deeply saddened women, singing at first softly, then more resolutely, advanced slowly down the aisle. We sang as if our lives depended on it, as if our very freedom, our passions and bravery were being called forward to bear witness to the atrocities that were placed before us. We were united and strong. And I knew right there and then that nothing, nothing could ever break the spirit of the Chilbury Ladies' Choir. At first I couldn't bring myself to sing. The feeling was too immense. The extraordinary sound of our procession echoing around the empty church, too tragic to eclipse the dreadful finality of death. The weight in the box making me shudder with discomfort. In front of me, Kitty was struggling to hold the coffin up, her voice coming out piecemeal like fragile, broken china. And behind me, Venetia was inconsolable, heaving huge gulps of tears. I know that we are taught to think of death as a gentle passage of the soul from one place to the next. But the brutal bombing of a young mother seemed to contradict all of that. Make it into the abominable destruction of a very real, strong spirit. I felt Venetia's hand on my arm from behind me, and suddenly felt less isolated in my dismal reckoning of mankind, and found my voice. At first gravelly and croaky with tears, it soon gathered strength, clarity, deliberation, until I felt the sound of our combined voices encompass us like a warm halo of protection, making us aware of the precious life we all have, what it means, and however long it may last. As we reached the last majestic notes, we stood tightly at the front, breathlessly listening to the sounds of the closing song reverberating around us. With some effort, we gently lowered the coffin onto the low table, Mrs. B hoarsely whispering, "Gently, Mrs. Gibbs, gently." Then we glanced around at the looming emptiness of the space. On one side were the mothers and children from the school, and on the other was only old Mr. Dawkins, the brigadier with Rose, and now Henry, who had arrived while we were in the vestry. Then, at the very back of the church, I noticed that the colonel had slipped into the row on the left. My spot, the place I always liked to sit. He gave me a sad, tight-lipped smile, and I nodded in the direction of the brigadier, hoping he would get the hint and go and collect Rose from him, which he did, remaining at the front as the Chilbury Ladies' Choir went quietly into the choir stalls. Clearly upset, the vicar led us through the ghastly service. A series of words that seemed all too inadequate to describe the grief I felt inside. And although I tried to hold them back, thoughts of David,
and what I'd do if that telegram arrived, sprang into my mind, an ominous gleam of a possible future. I was snapped out of my miseries by the vicar announcing the Chilbury Ladies' Choir will now sing for us. We stood, and I took a few deep breaths before walking to the front, feeling unnerved and unable to go through with my task of leading, such a new endeavour to be making at this awful moment. At once stepping into a dead woman's shoes, and Prim's no less, with her magical presence gone, for the sake of poor Hattie. And then, a sudden anger shot through me. What vicious brutes did this to them? And a new emotion overcame me. Integrity, and a feeling of pride for everything we stand for. Pride in Hattie for striving on with Victor so far away, in danger at sea. Pride in Prim, for having the faith to take our choir to new heights. And pride in us, the Chilbury Ladies' Choir, for carrying through with our duty, to rejoice in their lives, to be strong and resilient enough to hold off our enemies, and to make sure their deaths are not in vain. The organ's introduction of Amazing Grace filtered through the empty church, sweeping through us like a clean, crisp wind. And I took up my baton and prepared the choir to give the finest performance of our short, eventful existence. And a tragic awe overwhelmed me as the clear, crystalline voices pierced the air with all the beauty that a woman's voice can attain, a soaring white dove in the everlasting tumult of war. When we had finished, the vicar announced that the children of the school wanted to sing for their dear teacher. And my heart broke as I watched the children, most of them 8 or 9, wondering what had happened to wonderful Mrs. Lovell. It was the most tragic scene I'd ever encountered, the children covering their faces with their small hands to avoid looking at the coffin, in shock by the raw reality of death, how it could totally destroy something so warm and alive. At the burial, our sorry group stood silently as Hattie's coffin was lowered into the sodden ground beside her parents, before we made our way back to Ivy House for tea and sandwiches. I walked home with the Colonel, who had slipped the sleeping rose into her pram, a black one that had been lent to me from a nurse friend in Lichfield, as Hattie's blue one had been crushed in the bombing. She'd been so proud of it. I remembered when she brought it round to show me, pleased as punch, the first of many such memories to haunt me. I found myself pondering about Hattie and Prim and their lives, and thinking of my own insignificant time left on this planet, and how it might be shortened by bombs or invasion or who knows what. Later that day, after our desolate assembly had left with tears and embraces, I found myself talking about it to the Colonel. "That could have been my funeral," I said quietly, sitting at the kitchen table, drawing my fingernail down a crevice in the wood. "That bomb could have come 100 yards in this direction and hit us." "Yes, but let's not think about that until it happens, eh?" the Colonel replied and drew up a chair. It was early evening, and the gloomy grey of the day was dimming into a stormy-looking night. "But if we don't think of our death until we die, how can we decide how we want to live?" I looked at my hands, thin and wrinkled and bony, their freshness lost. If it had been my funeral, it would have been a sorry affair. "You're tired," the Colonel said, getting up. "Let me make you a cup of tea." He went and filled the kettle. "I've just been thinking about Hattie and Prim, wondering why I've spent my life working away to make other people happy. Why didn't I make my own life more fun and happy and more purposeful?" He sat back down. "Now look here," he said in a very authoritative way. "You have a great life. You have a lovely home. Brought up David." I broke him off to say, "who is at war and may not come back alive. You have a son," he went on, "and you are an incredible help and support to everyone around you." He put his hands on the table emphatically. "Can't you see how much this village needs you? They'd be lost without you. I put my head down, feeling self-conscious, and then I suddenly got up and snatched my dishcloth brusquely. Oh, enough of this self-indulgence, I muttered. I need to get on with dinner. I'm afraid I'm a little behind today. He came up beside me, guiding me back to the table with his firm, big hands on my shoulders. You just sit back down, he said gently. I can make dinner tonight. And he went over to the larder and took stock of the contents. Excellent news. We have some eggs, and eggs are my speciality. He took the box out and promptly started looking for a pan. Scrambled or boiled? He asked as he opened the cupboard and began banging around. Scrambled, I replied, smiling. I can't remember the last time someone cooked me dinner, even if it was only eggs. Excellent choice, madam, he smiled. My girls swear that I make the best scrambled eggs in the whole of Oxfordshire. Albeit a little overcooked, he made them very well indeed, singing a dreadfully out-of-tune rendering of It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Of course I felt obliged to sing along as he kept getting the words wrong and coming into the chorus too soon. It was ridiculous, us singing around the kitchen while cooking the scrambled eggs, but it cheered me up. And so, dear diary, as I go to bed tonight, I feel that this war has become a turning point for me. I need to be more sure of myself, make the most of the time I have left. Stand up and make myself heard.
Letter from Miss Edwina Poultry to her sister, Clara. Lichfield Hospital, Lichfield, Kent. Tuesday, 6th of August, 1940. Dear sister, why has this happened to me? My house was ruddy well bombed, and I'm stuck here in bleeding Lichfield Hospital with no way of finding my money, which is buried in the rubble of my house, waiting for the looters to find it first. You're probably wondering what happened. A sodding great bomb did, that's what. Thursday night, and there was I, all tucked up nicely in bed, when next thing I hear the air raid going, and have to hoist my exhausted body up. I was just going for the floorboard to get the money when, blam! Nothing! Until I wake up in this dreadful place with the biggest pain in my hip you'd ever know, and my leg in bandages too. Please remain calm and quiet, Miss Poultry, the nurse told me in her patronising manner. It's only a fractured hip. You'll be out in a few weeks. We have patients in with far more severe wounds than you. What about my money? I felt like yelling. But instead, I snivelled into my hands and started thinking up a plan. And then it came to me. The woman in the next bed is one of those horrible hop pickers from Dawkins Farm, and she has a few young fellows visiting her. Yesterday, I asked her if her nephew might be able to do me a favour, that there would be money in it for him, if he could be trusted. The next day, she got him to come to my bed to find out what it was about. "What do you want me to do, then, missus?" he said plainly. I looked him over and wasn't at all sure. He was tall and gangly, scruffy as a chimney sweep, with floppy loose hands and a pasty, moist complexion. "It's Tom, isn't it?" I said, trying not to crease my forehead. Was this really the best I could do? "Now, can I be sure you can keep your word, Tom? As I have a great task for you, but you have to reassure me that I can depend on you." "You can trust me, missus," he replied easily, hands on hips. Hardly the thing to fill me with confidence, but I proceeded nonetheless. You see, I have an amount of money hidden in the remains of my house. Not a large sum, you know, but you see, I've been saving up for my poorly sister, who's in need of a wheelchair. Maybe you'll be the one to need it now with your leg and all, he said, not meaning to be impertinent. I felt like giving up there and then. Maybe I will need it. And then she can use it afterwards. But the long and the short is that I am trapped here in hospital and my house is likely to be looted. I need you to get the money and bring it here to me. I will give you some of the money for your trouble. He looked at me, sucking in his lips. How much? 10 shillings, I said in a final way,
Rightio. He sniffed, wiping his nose with his shirt sleeve. Where is it, then? I stalled, asking him to fetch some water for me. His easy attitude unsettled me. He was fine with 10 shillings an hour, but once he saw the thick watch, he'd change his tune as quick as a jackrabbit. Would I even see the money again? His lack of haggling made me doubt him. Here you are, missus. He handed me the water. Perhaps I'd got him wrong. Perhaps he was just a simple child who wanted to help. I didn't have many options, dear sister. The money may have already gone or been burnt to ashes. This was the only possible means I had of reclaiming it. It was my only hope. All right, then. Listen carefully. He bent his head closer, and I explained where the money was hidden, making sure that he understood that the bomb damage may have shifted the floor or the money to another place. He was to leave no brick unturned. "I'll do my best," he said, with a lopsided, crooked-toothed smile. And my heart sank. What has the world come to? And so I will keep you informed as to how it goes. He promised to return as soon as he finds it. And in the meantime, I can only lie here and hope. Edwina.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Tuesday, the 6th of August, 1940. Dear Angela, you wouldn't believe what mayhem and sadness has been going on since the bomb. I'm shattered even thinking about it, and try to stay in my room resting as much as I can, although I did make it to Hattie's funeral, which was heartrending. I still can't quite believe she's gone. We've been friends since we were born, together as babies, then little girls, teenagers, and now grown women. Or rather, now just one woman. Me. It's as if a whole chunk of my past life has been obliterated. I'm still very weak. Mrs. Tilling comes to see me every day to tut over me, as she doesn't think I'm making enough progress. Mama has been wonderful, helping me through with lots of soup and good food. I worry that she has been giving me her rations, and Kitty's too, probably, as I've had eggs every day and bacon at least 3 times this week. My father is furious with Mama for being so nice to me, but has stayed away, for which I can only be grateful. I think he's playing a waiting game, lurking quietly in the wings until I become well enough to deal with his wrath. He expects me to marry someone else quickly, so that I can pretend that the baby is my new husband's, by which we all mean Henry, even though no one's saying it. Sweep it under the rug once and for all. It never dawns on him that I might not want to marry anyone else. I just want Alistair back. I keep wondering if he's out there somewhere. And if he is, why is he not coming back to me? I imagine him walking through the door, putting his arms around me as if nothing happened. I know I should be loathing him right now, but I can't. I feel that I love him even more, with every ounce of strength I can muster. It's as if the bombs have made everything transparently clear. Now all I want is him. But it's been 5 days since the bombs, and with every day, the chance that he is alive gets slimmer. As where might he be otherwise? There are 3 things that would account for his disappearance, none of them good. The first is that he was shot in the woods, either by my father or by a member of his underworld, and now lies dead in a ditch. And the second is that he was bombed in his house, although they tell me that no remains were found in the wreckage. The third option is that he left the village that evening, after our argument, and has not returned. I wear his St. Christopher every day, slipping the tiny silver beneath the front of my dress so that no one can see. It makes me think he is out there somewhere, thinking of me, whether it's here on earth or from some kind of heaven, looking down on me. Meanwhile, Henry was back for Hattie's funeral and came to see me this afternoon. I'd seen him after the funeral, of course, where we spoke about Hattie, and I must confess, it was rather nice to have him there, another one of our old childhood gang. He's so gentle these days. It's hard not to warm to him, although he seems less keen than he was in the spring, and I wondered how much he'd been told about Alistair. Mrs. B is such a belligerent gossip, although I'm sure she doesn't know the intimate details of what happened between Alistair and me. Henry's bound to disapprove of me spending time with him, but obviously he'd never show it. Mama begged me to come downstairs to see Henry, and I leant on her arm as she brought me into the drawing room, which seemed so light and airy and formal compared to my little room. She'd opened the door to the patio, and a fresh scent of grass cuttings wafted in with a cool breeze. The sunlight reflected in the great silver mirror above the fireplace, and shimmered around the pale walls and furnishings. And I wondered how lovely it would be to live in a past era, one where people were civil and poised, one where everything made sense, one where innocent people didn't get killed by bombs or vanish into thin air. "Henry," I said carefully, giving him my hand to shake and sitting on the taut grey sofa. I felt rather nervous for some reason, and had put on some lipstick and brushed my hair. He was looking excessively proper and respectable with his uniform so tidy, his handshake so measured. "Hello, Venetia," he said, smiling into my eyes. "Wonderful to see you." He glanced around the room, selected a sofa opposite me, and sat down, taking off his hat and placing it on the seat next to him. "I heard that you're quite the hero in these parts." "So they say." I laughed a little with embarrassment. "It was rather stupid, actually, running into an exploding building."
"But it was terribly brave of you. Not everyone would have risked their own life so readily. People are saying how well you did, with your wounds and so forth."
I flinched at the "and so forth," wondering if for some mad reason he knew about the pregnancy. No, of course he doesn't. Not even Alistair knows about the pregnancy. I saw him register my movement and hastily pulled myself together. "A lot of fuss, that's all," I smiled, trying to find another topic of conversation.
"And you too. Mrs. B tells us you're to get a medal."
"Well, Mama has a lot of notions, and I'm not sure if I'll get a medal. But I have been shooting a lot of the enemy down, which is the main thing."
"We owe so much to you, pilots. Fighting back against the Nazis. They would have invaded by now if you hadn't frightened them off." I was trying to sound bold and strong, but the words came tumbling out all smattered with potholes. I could see him taking in my attempts to be normal, as if I were less beautiful, more unkempt, as if he was thinking about how much I'd changed. And I have changed. But somehow I didn't want him to think that. I wanted him to think I was exactly the same. "I'm looking a bit of a mess, I'm afraid," I said, tossing my hair back as I would usually, putting more of a swing into my voice. "I haven't been so well since the air raid."
"Yes, I heard," he said warmly. "I hope I'm not putting you out, getting you up like this."
"No, it's nice to see you. In any case, you'll be gone in a few days, and I wouldn't want to miss you."
"It's funny being back after all that's happened. The air raid, Prim and Hattie, the disappearance of that fellow. What was his name again?"
He stood up and went to the mantelpiece, interested in the craftsmanship as he ran his fingers over the elaborate white edging. "Slater," I said quickly, trying not to put any inflection on the name. "Mr. Slater, no one knows what's happened to him."
"I heard that you were going to his house the night of the raid."
He didn't turn around, just continued studying the mantelpiece.
"I wondered if you were having a liaison of sorts."
"Well, I was, as a matter of fact," I said boldly. I could hardly lie when it was now common knowledge, but I confess, I really didn't care to discuss this with Henry. I didn't want him to know. It wasn't his business, and I somehow didn't think it would be useful. But it wasn't a big thing, just a spot of fun.
"Oh, I see."
He turned and looked at me, straight in the eyes.
"I wondered. That's all."
He walked towards me and sat down beside me on the sofa. A worried look had come over his face.
"Are you all right, Venetia? I mean, are you really all right? Deep down inside?"
I nearly burst out crying.
Of course I'm not all right. The man I love has gone, and I have his child growing inside me. I'm scared to death I'll lose the baby, and I try to stay in bed all day. I'm petrified of what's going to happen. I'm fine, I said quietly, rearranging my skirt on my lap. Really, I'm fine.
You just look so different, not the same Venetia as you were. You seem, well,
he paused in thought.
Lost.
I had to get up. Being so close and him being so terrifically frank with me was all too much. It would be too easy for me to cry my eyes out on his shoulder. We've known each other since we were children. He is one of my best friends. But I know that revealing everything would do me no favours. I walked over to the piano and began straightening out the music, which is all higgledy-piggledy on top. I lost a lot of blood, that's all. It's been rather exhausting, frankly.
Yes, he said,
but he seemed to be dwelling on something quite different.
What can one do?
Our eyes met, and I know he was trying to read me, trying to get inside. He must have seen me let my guard down, as he got up swiftly and took a step towards me.
Venetia.
I don't know if he was coming to take me in his arms, or kiss me, or just to be close, but I stepped back, keeping him away. How awful of me not to offer you tea! I darted for the door. As I left, I registered his disappointment, or was it annoyance, at my escape, and remembered uneasily that I had been encouraging him the few times we'd last met. An awful vision of David's leaving party scorched through my head. Why had I played those ridiculous games with him? When I returned some minutes later, he was standing by the patio door, looking down over the yellowing lawn, the unpruned roses, the fountain turned off to save water. He had changed his tone completely, becoming charming and impersonal, an RAF pilot on a jaunt, keeping his buddies up to date with amusing stories. He's so terribly witty these days, getting me laughing about some prank his friend got up to, asking too many girls out at the same time. I know the pilots are incredibly popular with the girls, and I imagine he has more than his fair share with his amiable bonhomie. But I somehow missed that tense moment from before, and tried in vain to recapture it. But he resolutely kept up his light and impersonal banter. That is, until he left. I had walked into the front door, and we stood together on the brink, the sky fading to a darker shade of its former brilliance, the sound of a barn owl piercing through the still air from the wood. He turned to me, his eyes boring into me again, his hand reaching out for mine.
I hate to leave you like this, Venetia. Please, let me help you.
He kissed my hand in an old-fashioned way, his eyes flickering up to meet mine for an intense moment, before he smiled, said goodbye, and turned down the path. I leant on the doorframe and watched the back of him as he walked away into the late afternoon haze. He looked so very manly in his uniform, all rational and not losing his head. It was hard to remember the boy he had once been. The time we had kissed by the river when we were both about 14. Of course, it was forgotten quickly, and we never spoke about it again. But as I stood there watching him walk away, I wondered what it would be like to be Henry's wife. Perhaps not so very bad after all. I spent the rest of the night thinking long and hard about Alistair. Where had he gone? Why did he leave me? Even though he didn't know about the baby, what about his love for me? Did I mean so little to him that he could just leave? And what if he was lost in the flames, or killed by Daddy, or any number of spies or black marketeers, or on the run from the police or the army or the intelligence service? What had I been thinking to fall in love with such a man? And yet, when I recall the passion, the poetry... But where has it gone, Angie? Where has he gone? How could he desert me when I need him most? I began to look at it practically. If he is in hiding, or has vanished to a new safe haven, then he doesn't care for me, and I have to get on as well as I can by myself. And if he is dead, well, I need to get on too. Whichever way it is, I can't sit here in my room and wait for him to return.
I have a baby growing inside me. Soon it will be too late for me to deal with this. Tonight I took off the St. Christopher and felt its lightness in my palm, and then I looked out of my open window into the night and prayed on the first star that I saw.